Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Kathleen O'Sullivan for the Seattle Times, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, your clock counts down. We'll try to help you look at it.
Thank you. District Court's lengthy opinion rests on 4 clear mistakes on the law, and each of these errors matter. 3 fundamental mistakes under CERCLA and 1 under the contract with Touchstone. The CERCLA errors include a misunderstanding of the relationship between Section 107A of CERCLA and 113F, the substantial compliance standard for consistency with the National Contingency Plan, and the standard for operator liability under CERCLA. And under the contract, the core mistake was the district court simply eviscerated the right that Seattle Times had under the contract to select the location where the contaminated soils were disposed of. So first, on the 107A-113F distinction, the United States Supreme Court in the Atlantic Research case explained that these are different statutory provisions with different, clearly distinct remedies available to parties in different circumstances. A 107A right is a right to cost recovery. It was the only claim available to Seattle Times. It is clearly distinct from a 113F contribution claim, and the difference matters for several reasons. First, 107A is a strict liability statute. Equity doesn't matter. That doesn't come in until the contribution claim under 113F. Which brings me to the second reason it matters, and that's the burden of proof. Seattle Times, as the plaintiff on the 107A claim, had the burden of establishing the elements of that claim, but on the burden of proof, Lethercare had the burden. And Lethercare was not held to that burden, and the burden of proof matters. And the third reason why it really matters here and why this case is different is the orphan share issue. The orphan share issue is the only hook under which the district court allocated any share of the costs to Seattle Times. Seattle Times said that Lethercare and Troy were equally at fault and deserved the liability, but then on the orphan share issue, assigned a percentage of that liability to Seattle Times.
I thought this was liability without fault. In many of these CERCLA cases, the discharge of the substances that give rise to the litigation occurred many years ago when it was a perfectly lawful, permissible discharge. Before the environmental laws of the 70s were even passed into law. I don't really understand the emphasis on Seattle passively holding the contaminated property as opposed to running a dry cleaning shop there.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor, that 107A, it's a strict liability statute. If those statutory elements are met, and Lethercare stipulated to nearly all of them, including that it operated the facility, then there is presumptively joint and several liability.
And everybody knows this. It's like if you buy an old gas station, you know that the property is going to subject you to claims.
Well, but Judge Zille's mistake here was in saying this was effectively a contribution suit. He threw all the claims together in one pot instead of first addressing the 107A strict liability elements, and only then turning to the equitable aspect on the contribution side. He just put them all together. He said so directly. He treated this as effectively a contribution suit.
Counsel, under 107A, would Seattle Times have had to perform some remediation before 107A applied?
What Seattle Times needed to do was to have incurred some costs that were necessary, and Seattle Times did incur substantial
remediation.
Costs. Right. Seattle Times incurred nearly $5 million in costs to clean up the property. And so it did satisfy that standard, and that was...
How were those costs incurred?
Those costs were incurred pursuant to a contract Seattle Times had with Touchstone. So a contract that Seattle Times entered voluntarily, was not forced by the EPA or a state environmental agency.
So it was in the nature of reimbursement as opposed to Seattle Times in the first instance engaging in remediation and expending costs for that.
Not in the sense of reimbursement like an insurance company, like the Chubb case that the parties
have... Well, insurance company is more in the nature of indemnification, but I kind of see this agreement that Seattle Times had with Touchstone as being Touchstone will do the cleanup and then Seattle Times will reimburse.
Well, Seattle Times directly paid. It literally incurred, and we provided the dictionary definition of the agreement to insure. It paid out of pocket nearly $5 million pursuant to the contract. And the letter here stipulated those costs were necessary. Only on appeal do they question for the first time whether that was the case.
Well, I'm just curious as to whether that meets the definition under 107A.
Yes, they stipulated that the costs incurred were necessary, and by a plain meaning definition of incur, they paid, they did so voluntarily. To turn to the next issue, the substantial compliance standard, this court in the Carson Harbor 2 case explained that substantial compliance, not perfect consistency, is the standard. And this issue matters because it is the one aspect of Seattle Times 107A claim that Leather Care disputes. And there was substantial compliance. This is a very detailed, more than 100-page feasibility study that analyzed multiple alternatives, three alternatives at great length, what was the different cost, effectiveness, implementability, and it selected the least costly alternative. And this plan was agreed to. It was an agreed order by the Washington State Department of Ecology. So it was good enough for the state of Washington, but it wasn't good enough for the district court here, who said that, well, they only considered one alternative, and that's simply not true. You can look at that order, and there are three alternatives that were considered in great detail, and others considered at the screening stage, which is permitted by the regulations.
I'm having trouble attaching your argument to the environmental remediation and indemnity agreement. Am I looking at the wrong agreement? If that's the agreement, it just seems short, simple, straightforward, and clear. The purchaser has the right to remove and dispose of the soils at its own expense and seek reimbursement from the seller. That's what it says.
The agreement is quite straightforward, Your Honor, just a few pages long. And one of the most straightforward aspects, to quote from it, was that the seller, that's Seattle Times, shall have the right to select the disposal site for contaminated soils removed from the property.
Okay, I missed that. Where's that sentence? I see where they have the right to have a consultant and a contractor to have reasonable access to the property, but where's the part about how they get to pick what to do with it?
Right. I'm on ER 868, which is page 2.
That's where I am.
Right. Okay, so you look under 2 bullet, seller's remediation, that heading is bolded.
Yep.
And then you go to the second full paragraph, beginning seller and purchaser contemplate.
Yep. Got it.
And it is... 5 lines down there.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, thanks. Now I found it.
Right. So that is an express right under the contract that the district court's judgment simply eviscerated. And the explanation for doing so is what follows 2 sentences later. that seller shall not unreasonably interfere with any ongoing development project, but it can't be unreasonable interference to stand on an express right in the contract. And another supposed reason given for by Touchstone as to why they didn't want Seattle Times to be able to stand on its right is that it would have led to construction delays.
Wait, can I interrupt? This is Judge Fletcher. Can I interrupt for just a minute?
Yes.
Have we just skipped to your second set of arguments that are based on the contract and moved away from the CERCLA arguments?
I'm happy to go back to
where we are, because you started out with your 107 argument, 107, 113 argument. You'd gone through the substantial compliance argument, and you skipped over the operator argument, but we're now on the contractual argument. Is that where we are?
Yes. I was trying to address Judge Kleinfeld's questions about the contract.
That's okay. I just want to understand the sequence of the arguments and what's relevant to what. I got it.
Okay. I do want to go back to operator liability because it's an important part of the appeal.
Okay. Please.
Well, I'll just jump to that right now. Again, when it comes to operator liability under CERCLA, there is a United States Supreme Court case on point, the Best Food case. And this is an issue, the district court just got it wrong. And again, it matters for several reasons. It matters because of the orphan here again in determining, well, if Troy's not in the picture, who would be next to pay? It would make sense that Leather Care, as the actual polluter, would be first, then Mr. Red, you know, and only then below that stand of causation with Seattle Times come in. It also matters collectability. This may
now,
be the rare.
Let me make sure I understand exactly what the operator argument is aimed at. Is it aimed at anything other than the decision that Mr. Red is not an operator?
No, it is simply aimed at that matter.
And so the only question is whether Mr. Ritt is an operator.
Exactly. And I was simply trying to explain why it matters.
Yeah. But it's only directed to Mr. Ritt. Okay.
And the reason he is the operator, the Supreme Court said this is another, it's a plain language test. What does it mean to operate? It means to manage. It means to manage the operations of a facility. And if I could ask you to look at one page in the excerpt of record, in addition to the contract, that's page 371. And Mr. Ritt admitted he had blood on the clothing, that he was responsible for managing the pipes. He personally selected, installed.
You know, I would have no trouble with your argument. It would seem quite compelling to me if we were reviewing a summary judgment. But since we're reviewing a trial verdict, findings by the judge, it's a lot harder because of the clear error standard. My problem with your argument on writ is the judge could think, well, yeah, he dumped the stuff into the back of the truck and into the I can't remember what you call them, side sewers or something like that. But he was not the guy who controlled the truck or the side sewers. His landlord did. And when we're reviewing for clear error, I wonder if that's enough to save the district court's conclusion on whether Ritt should be treated as an operator.
Your Honor, we have brought this as a de novo challenge to the meaning of the statute. I think even under a clear error standard, we would win. But the meaning of the word operate in a statute is a classic question of law. And if you look at the district court's reasoning, he said he had no control over the side sewers, that was his language, or over the dump truck. That cannot be squared with the holding that Leather Care itself is an operator. And Leather Care, under that theory, also had no control over the side sewers of the dump truck, and they shouldn't have even been considered an operator under the statute. So that's simply illogical, and it is inconsistent with the standard also from this court in a case that predates Best Foods, and then this court has reaffirmed that since Best Foods in the City of L.A. Versus San Pedro.
The following question occurs to me, but it may be a detour. But ordinarily, when we're talking about operators in a case like this, we're talking about a company that does something. We don't ordinarily talk about the owner of the company or the CEO of the company. We hold the company responsible as an operator. Why are we going after Mr. Ritt independently of his company as a separate operator?
Right. I'll give you an answer under the law and a practical answer. Under the law, again, this is a statutory construction issue, and person, CERCLA, is defined to include both corporations and individuals. So under CERCLA itself, it's permissible to hold.
But does that statute mean that any person operating within the structure of a corporation is liable in addition to the corporation itself?
Absolutely not, Judge Fletcher. And we cited on a reply brief about six federal circuits from other circuits. We couldn't find one from this court that have grappled with this issue and have concluded as a matter of law, an individual officer can be liable, but it depends what was his or her authority to control and personal involvement. So you have a case in the Fifth Circuit, Riverside, where you had kind of an absentee president lived in New York, only at the plant a few times a year. That person's not being held liable under CERCLA, but the persons who are actively engaged, the Fourth Circuit case we cited, Carolina Transformer, in that instance, it is appropriate. And as a practical matter, because of explaining why it matters for the orphan share, it matters for collectability. I set my time is approaching below 3 minutes, so I would like to reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
This is a complicated enough case. Rather than cut you off here and deprive you of rebuttal time, I would like to hear you on the point that we got started on, which is the transportation issue as to whether or not it goes to Wenatchee or to Roosevelt.
Yes, absolutely. So
that's where the big money is.
There's money all around in this case, Your Honor. But yes, that was a critical part of the decision by the district court, and it was simply wrong. And it eviscerated this plain right the Seattle Times had to select the location, and you don't need to look at parole evidence to come to that conclusion.
But of course, you had the right only to select the location. You did not have the right to select the means of transportation, and you also did not have the right unreasonably interfere with the project undertaken by Touchstone. So if I read that, and it's all within a few sentences, I think it's a plausible reading of that contract that, yes, you can choose the location where it's going to go, but at the same time, you cannot unreasonably interfere with the project and it's going forward. And if you were to choose Roosevelt and to insist upon it going by rail, that was going to slow things down. You could have chosen Roosevelt, and Touchstone would have said, well, okay, fine, but I'm going to do it by truck, and it's going to cost you a lot of money. So instead of doing that, I'm going to cost you less money than sending it to Roosevelt by truck. I'm going to send it to Wenatchee by truck, and that's going to save you some money. So I don't understand what Touchstone did wrong here.
A few responses, Your Honor. What the district court did wrong fundamentally is his interpretation of incremental costs was inconsistent in the opinion. So incremental cost is defined as
Could you respond to the Roosevelt versus Wenatchee question?
Okay,
I'm not interested in incremental costs at the moment.
Okay. I was trying to get to the construction free issue. Touchstone asserts that it kind of presumed that Roosevelt versus Wenatchee, that the prices were essentially the same, or they were almost doing Seattle Times a favor, picking the least expensive option. And I have an invoice for you to look at. It starts at TSER 520, That's the Touchstone excerpts of record. And if you look at page 524, you'll actually see side by side what was the cost for Roosevelt and what was the cost for Wenatchee. And there's a stark difference. So Seattle Times beef was not with the method.
I'm sorry, I don't have that page in front of me. Give me the page number again. I'll look at it later. But what's the page number you're looking at?
TSER 524.
And what does it show?
What it shows is that Roosevelt has $56.46 the unit rate, and Wenatchee
by truck or by train.
It only gives one. It just simply lists the amount.
But it doesn't tell me whether that's by truck or by train.
Not
because the truck or by train, the costs are very different.
Well, they assert that, but I'm just showing you what's in their own invoice.
Well, but what you told me so far doesn't tell me that they're wrong to say that it's cheaper to go by truck to Wenatchee than it is to go by truck to Roosevelt.
Well,
I know the geography, and I can see that it would be cheaper to go by truck to Wenatchee. Roosevelt, a lot of little roads way in the southeast corner, right across from Arlington. That's a bad truck route to take. It's going to take you a long time. It's going to be expensive.
They assert that, but what is in their invoice is simply the comparison of Roosevelt versus Wenatchee by these methods, with Wenatchee being far more expensive. And so Seattle Times was standing...
Far more expensive than what? Than by train. I understand it's more expensive than by train, but the question is it more expensive to go to Wenatchee by truck? Because you had the right to choose the location. You did not have the right to choose the method by which you could get to the location. So if they're going to say, listen, I'm not going to hold up my schedule, I'm going to, and I will send it to the place you want, but the only way I can keep on schedule is to do it by truck, and it's going to cost you a lot of money.
Yes, I hear this, and let me try to answer more artfully. The questions and their argument presume there was a neat package of three different options, but that's not what was in the invoices presented to Seattle Times.
Okay.
Judge Fletcher, may I ask a final question on
107A?
So, counsel, when I ask you whether or not Seattle Times came within the statute, you didn't address the requirement that the response be consistent with the national contingency plan. And the district court found that it was not consistent with the national contingency plan. So if we agree with the district court that the response was not consistent with the national contingency plan, would you agree then that 107A did not apply to Seattle Times?
The answer is there's a reading of 107A that national contingency plan consistency only applies to damages, but we recognize this court in Carson Harbor 2 suggests it's an element of the prima facie case. So our position is simply that there was substantial compliance. This plan was approved by the State Department of Ecology and considered multiple alternatives.
Well, but what I ask you was, if we agree with the district court that the response did not comply with the national contingency plan, then would 107A not apply to Seattle Times?
We'd have one more argument there, Your Honor, and that's the harmless error standard. That what substantial compliance means is that immaterial deviations are not a barrier to liability. And so then you would need to ask, would some other conceivable alternative been actually used?
But that would require us to reverse the district court's decision. So if we went along with the district court decision and did not reverse it, then Seattle Times would not come within 107A. Is that correct?
The answer is yes, assuming you find there was no substantial compliance and no harmless error, which is a question the district court didn't answer. So the more appropriate issue would be to remand to ask the district court to consider that issue in the first instance.
All right, thank you.
Okay, now, we've taken you over time. This is a case of sufficient complexity that I think it is entirely understandable that we would have done so, and we will give you a chance to respond in rebuttal.
Thank you so much.
I think Leathercare is going first in response.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, now I'm sorry, I'm a little slow on this. So review the betting for me in terms of how you're going to divide up the 20 minutes.
Sure. My name is Kristen Meyer. I am going to address the CERCLA 107-113 issue.
Yeah.
Taking no more than 5 minutes.
How long do you anticipate taking?
5 minutes at most.
Five, okay. And then what happens?
And then my colleague, Ms. Flannery, will take 15 minutes to address the remaining issues as to Leathercare and Mr. Ritt.
I see. So you're spending 5 minutes on the 107-113 issue. All the rest of the issues will be addressed by your colleagues in the 15 minutes.
Correct. If I take 5 minutes, I will do my best to take less.
Okay, there we go. I've got it. When you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, my name is Kristen Meyer, representing Leathercare and Mr. Ritt, addressing the 107-113 claim that Ms. O'Sullivan has just been addressing. Now, as a threshold issue, the district court got it right at summary judgment in denying a 107A judgment because Seattle Times didn't meet all of the elements of the claim.
Hear you. What did he say?
That the
volume's a little low.
Okay. Is this better?
Yes,
okay. I'll just talk very loud. Thank you, Your Honor. Seattle Times did not meet all of the elements of a 107A claim in order to obtain summary judgment. It concedes that one of the elements of a prima facie 107A claim is consistency with the NCD, which they reserve for trial. So certainly at the summary judgment stage, it was appropriate for the district court to deny that summary judgment. Now, even if Seattle Times had obtained either at summary judgment or even at trial, a judgment on the 107A claim, the fact that Leathercare asserted a 113F counterclaim and the district court found that Seattle Times was a potentially responsible party because they had stipulated to the elements of that, then 113F controls. And as the Fourth Circuit has described it, it negates any 107A claim or any judgment under 107, because at that point, the district court is required to equitably allocate all of the response costs severally among all of the potentially responsible parties. So that even if there was a judgment under 107A, and then the court allocates under 113, the allocation is what rules and is the judgment in the case.
So what do you do with the question? What do you do with the question raised by the Seattle Times saying, well, yes, that's all true, but it really makes a difference whether we're proceeding under 107 or under 113 because the burden of proof changes. What do you do with that argument?
Well, the burden of proof in this case, the Leathercare had a burden under MOTCA, and it had the same burden under CERCLA. And so when the court allocated equitably in its order, it says, I would have allocated the same way under CERCLA, and I would have allocated the same way under MOTCA. Leathercare asserted a MOTCA claim and a CERCLA claim, and it had the same burden to do so. Actually, each party asserted a claim under MOTCA. There is no indication in the district court's order that it had only looked at its allocation under Seattle Times' burden under MOTCA.
Appears if the clock is running.
You're right.
Oh. Thank you. I missed that.
I'll still try to be brief and not take up this 5 minutes.
Well, say what you need to say.
Okay. So the burden here is the court got it right. The court didn't indicate that it was only looking at this allocation under a particular burden. And regardless of the burden, the evidence is sufficient to support the court's conclusions, both that Troy used PCE and that Troy was immune from suit, that it was defunct, and therefore an orphan share. And we don't even need to get to any of this, of course, unless this court resurrects the CERCLA claim, which the
now,
district
let me make sure I understand the argument you just made with respect to allocation under state law. I want to make sure I understand the argument. You can correct me if I'm wrong. You're saying that even if the district judge made a mistake and that he should have said that there was a good claim under CERCLA under 107 and shifted the burden of proof for allocation to the other side, that he actually did so when he was reviewing the state law claim, so we know what he was going to do. Is that the argument?
Correct. So even if
if there is a 107 mistake, you say it's harmless because we know what he was going to do when the burden of proof shifts.
Correct, because the burden already had shifted under the state law, or at least Leather Care had a burden under the state law, just as it does under the CERCLA counterclaim.
I get the argument.
And of course, this is all theoretical unless this court resurrects the CERCLA claim. That's the only time at which the burden would be relevant. And so at that point, I would like to hand this over to my colleague unless any of you have any further questions on the 107-113 issue.
I think not. So let's hear from your colleague.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Your Honors. Joe Flannery for Leather Care and Mr. Ritt. Are you able to hear me at this volume?
Yes, thanks.
I'm going to address the consistency with NCP, Ritt's personal liability, and our prevailing party cross appeals, and we're going to stand on our briefing for the attorney fee appeals.
I need your help on something that's bothering me so I can put it behind me and listen to the rest of your argument.
Yes.
I'm wondering why we don't have to reverse on attorney's fees so that the Seattle Times can recover attorney's fees from Leather Care. It seems like they're a prevailing party against Leather Care because they got a money judgment against Leather Care. What am I missing there?
So as to the prevailing party, if you were going to agree with Seattle Times' argument, it would require you to ignore two important things at the same time. It would require this court to ignore the rest of the judgment, all except for paragraph 8, and it would require this court to ignore an entire body of Washington State prevailing party law. And that prevailing party law, this is important because basically Seattle Times really concedes this appeal at page 4 and 5 of their reply brief. You'll see that they cite extensively from the Douglas versus Shamrock paving case. And Douglas cites extensively to Washington prevailing party case law.
I'm having trouble following the answer. You're telling me there's a whole lot of law that explains why the Times is not a prevailing party against Leather Care despite winning a money judgment against them, but you haven't told me what the law says.
Okay. So, in Washington, if you do not wholly prevail over the other party, and we know that Seattle Times did not wholly prevail over Leather Care, because we look at the judgment at paragraph 3, 6, and 10, we know they didn't wholly prevail. Then we go to the next step and we say, did Leather Care receive some judgment in its favor? The answer is yes. Again, look at the judgment at paragraphs 3, 6, and 10. So Leather Care is a party that has an affirmative judgment rendered in its favor. Seattle Times did not wholly prevail over Leather Care, and that's plain on the face of the judgment. That triggers the next inquiry. And under risk, which is also cited with approval in the Douglas case that the Times relies on, the next inquiry that's required then is a weighing up of the wins and losses. If neither party wholly prevailed over the other, then this weighing up process must be done. And the court proceeded to do exactly that. It engaged in a weighing up of the wins and losses of each party, And even if you take out the, well, Seattle Times didn't prevail over Mr. Ritt, just take that out, you still have the weighing up of the wins and the losses, and the court concluded that neither party substantially prevailed over the other. And under Hertz versus Reby, Enos versus Ring, Wesch versus Martin, the 2019 Western District Court, court case that Touchstone cited, that was the Port of Ridgefield case, Washington law expressly authorizes the court to reach that conclusion. Neither party wholly prevailed over the other, neither is a prevailing party. Did that get to it?
How did Leather Care prevail over the Seattle Times?
So Seattle Times brought its own independent remedial action claim, and Leather Care completely defeated that claim. That's in the judgment at paragraph 3. That claim was completely dismissed. Seattle Times was seeking joint and several liabilities.
That's what I thought. You're talking about theories for obtaining relief, kind of like in a simple case where the plaintiff says, you owe me the money because it was negligence and also because you're strictly liable. And the jury concludes, or the judge concludes, there's no strict liability here, but they owe the money for ordinary negligence. That's a win, even though one of the theories for relief was defeated. And I think you're saying that Leather Care won in part because some of the theories for relief that the Times urged were defeated.
Your Honor, it's different than that. It was two separate claims. Seattle Times had a claim for a particular portion of money that was Touchstone's cleanup costs. And Seattle Times was saying, I paid Touchstone in my contract. I would like to be indemnified for those costs that were Touchstone's. Separately, Seattle Times said, and I have my own MOSCA claim for my independent remedial action, and I want costs from you for that. And Leather Care completely defeated that. Moreover, Seattle Times was actually pursuing Leather Care for 100% liability. They told the court, hey, you know, maybe give us 3% only if you have to, but they were really pursuing Leather Care for 100%. And the district court was very mindful of that. That came up over and over and over in the case, and it really drove the litigation. And they did not prevail on that. And then when it came to Leather Care's counterclaim and asking for a fair allocation of future costs, which has a monetary value, we prevailed, Leather Care prevailed, Seattle Times ended up with a greater share even. So they, Leather Care did receive some judgment in its favor, and that's the Washington State case law language, and we, Leather Care received an affirmative judgment in its favor.
Thank you.
I want to just touch on the NCP and consistency with the NCP. The framework for the feasibility study that Touchstone did was driven by Touchstone's real estate redevelopment plan. Touchstone was not trying to be consistent with the NCP. There are at least three substantive requirements that were completely left out of Touchstone's plan, and Seattle Times is mistaken in the material it presents to this court. The detailed analysis of viable alternative remedies was skipped altogether. Consideration of cost and alternate remedies was skipped altogether. Monitored natural attenuation for groundwater was skipped altogether. The relevant regulation is 40 CFR 300-430, and the pre-screening requirement discussed by Seattle Times comes in subsection E1. Before the required detailed analysis set forth in subsection E9, which is missing altogether. They're not the same thing. And if you look at the draft feasibility study at section 8.1, and this is ER 843 and 844 in the record, it plainly lists the remedial technologies that survive the subsection E1 pre-screening, and both soil vapor extraction and monitored natural attenuation are listed. Table 3 of the feasibility study, which is LSER 609, shows the results of the pre-screening. Both SVE and monitored natural attenuation survived the pre-screening. They were retained.
I have a question for you with respect to what standard the district judge applied to determine whether or not the plan complied. Did the district judge say that the test was substantial compliance?
Yes, Your Honor, substantial
compliance. As I read the opinion, and, I didn't see the word substantial with respect to this.
And even if he didn't use that word, the standard
is... Well, I'm asking, did he or did he not? You're saying he did, because I didn't see it.
I don't know if he used that word. Well, what he looked at was the fact that the three important elements at a minimum were missing. And this is it's not an immaterial or insubstantial deviation from the plan. This criteria is the heart of the regulation that is applied to make sure that the remedy that's selected is efficient and cost effective. So skipping those steps because you've pre-selected your remedy defeats the whole purpose of the regulation. That's
so, counsel. Is it your position that even if the substantial compliance standard were applied, that it was not met by Seattle Times?
Yes. Yes, these important steps were skipped altogether. They are neither immaterial nor insubstantial. If you look at the cost evaluation that was done, and here again, Seattle Times is just mistaken. Look at the record at LSER 611 through 614. This is where the cost evaluation is done, and the court will see that only excavation and only active groundwater treatment were considered for costs. Skipping that evaluation altogether is neither immaterial nor insubstantial. It defeats the whole purpose of the regulatory scheme. And I need to push on to Mr. Ritt and the personal liability issue. If I may, we've had some discussion about how CERCLA is a strict liability standard, and therefore it is essential to hold Seattle Times to its burden of proof, each essential element under the statute. And what matters, the relevant inquiry, is not whether Mr. Ritt is a former operator of just anything on any part of the property, but whether he personally operated the facility where the waste was disposed of, whether he personally operated the facility that actually released the hazardous substance.
Help me on something there. The Anchorage Times, Seattle Times, argued that you can't very well say that Rip wasn't the operator, his landlord was, without also saying Leather Care wasn't the operator, the landlord was. So it's inconsistent, logically inconsistent, to let Ritt off the hook and keep Leather Care on. It's got to be either both on the hook or both off the hook. What is the matter with that argument?
Okay. First, what's important is, what is the facility that is at issue? Who's operating what facilities? So Seattle Times is trying to just skip over the analysis.
The truck and the side sewers, right?
Right. And
okay,
so
why didn't neither of them operated the truck and the side sewers? So if you take that to be the facility, as opposed to taking the real estate where the dry cleaner operated as the facility, then Leather Care would have to be exonerated, wouldn't it?
And here are the differences. First, Leather Care straight up stipulated to liability. They didn't try to run away from this. It stipulated to liability early on, tried to streamline the case, which usually results in a settlement. That that didn't happen here. But Leathercare was also in a contractual relationship with Troy, and it had the non-exclusive right to use Troy's facilities, and there are other ways to find liability under the statutes, and those don't apply to Mr. Ritt. And here, Seattle Times is seeking Mr. Ritt's personal liability, separate and apart from the corporation. And the case law on operator liability clearly shows that personal involvement is required in the operation of the facility that actually, where the waste was deposited, or the facility that actually released the material, because that's part of the definition of a PRP or a PLP. And that is where Seattle Times is missing the boat. It was obligated to prove that Mr. Ritt personally operated the facility at which the hazardous material was disposed. That's the definition.
Counsel, is that the definition? I thought it also included the operator of the facility that generated the polluting substance that was ultimately disposed of.
So this is what I was saying. There are other definitions under CERCLA where liability can be found when you were concerned about Leathercare. Those were not at issue in this case, and they were not litigated in this case as to Mr. Ritt. So what's at issue as to Mr. Ritt is, did he personally operate the particular facility at which the material was disposed?
And was that the question on the statute?
Let me interrupt. Excuse me for a second. Was that the ground on which the district court found that Mr. Ritt was not an operator, or was it on did the district court do it on the ground that, well, wait a minute, it was the landlord's responsibility with respect to the dump truck and the side sewers?
So those two things are related, and you're right, the district court specifically found that the facilities at issue, and this is important, the facilities at issue were the Troy Laundry garbage truck and the Troy Laundry side sewers. Those are findings of fact that are unchallenged on appeal. And further, the court found, this is at ER 74 and 75, that Mr. Ritt had no operational control over the dump truck or the side sewers. That's also a finding of fact, which is unchallenged on appeal.
But it strikes me as a matter of law that that's a vulnerable holding, because Mr. Ritt clearly was in charge of the company that was generating the waste. So in that sense, he clearly is an operator. Now, the entity that dealt with what happened to the waste after he generated it is a different entity, but so he and his company generated the waste.
This is not a generator liability case. It's not a generator case. It's not an arranger case. This is only looking at whether Mr. Ritt can be held personally liable as a former operator, okay? And that's the analysis.
And liable for what? Liable for creating the toxic waste, or liable for putting it in the wrong place?
Well, the question is, can he be held personally liable for the cleanup costs for the waste that leaked out of the dump truck over which he had no control, for the waste that leaked out of Troy's side sewer over which he had no control? And here's what's important. We start with the corporate shield. In order to set aside the protection of the corporate shield, to find an individual corporate officer personally liable, case law discusses the type of personal involvement that's required. The person needs to be heavily involved, intimately participate in the operation of the facility at issue, personally involved in wrongful conduct. There's no finding of wrongful conduct.
It looks like that's not your problem. That's not the problem. He's the boss. It sounds like what you need is to define facility so that it just means the pickup truck and the side sewers, and not the real estate where the dry cleaner operated.
And, Your Honor, that is what the district court did. It made
particular findings. But counsel, was that consistent with the Washington Supreme Court decision in Pope?
Yes. In fact, Pope makes a point to say under MOTCA, our state statute, the focus when we look at operator liability isn't looking at any control, it's looking at the word control. And it's very particular to say, to be an operator, you must have operational control of the facility at issue. And here, again, the district court found, as you were saying, Your Honor, that the dump truck and the side stores, Troy's dump truck, Troy's side stores, were
counsel,
the,
but the language, the counsel, the language in Pope is much broader than you are articulating. It says the operator must manage, direct, or conduct operations specifically related to pollution, that is, operations having to do with the leakage or disposal of hazardous waste.
Yes,
so it's hard for me to see how you can limit the term just to the dump trucks under that broad language in Pope.
Your Honor, I want to make sure that this panel doesn't make the same mistake that Seattle Times is making. So looking at just that language about operational control, remember that Seattle Times had the burden to prove that Mr. Ritt was a PRP or a PLP. Did they prove each particular element of those definitions? And that is where, when we get back up to what Seattle Times missed, what it skipped, what it failed to prove, is that the operational control, and that language is in Pope, must be exerted over the facility at which the waste was disposed, the facility that released the hazardous waste. That is why Mr. Ritt is not personally liable and cannot be held personally liable in this case. Seattle Times did not meet its burden of proof to prove PLP or PRP. Did Mr. Ritt operate something, the PCE equipment inside LetterCare's facility? Maybe. That's not the correct analysis in this particular case. In the other liability cases that are cited, and this is important to relieve the court's mind, these other operator cases where individual corporate officers were found personally liable or might have been, they were personally and heavily, intimately involved with the particular facility that gave rise to the release, the particular facility where the waste was disposed of. They supervised employees that cut open transformers and let the oil leak right onto their facility. That kind of involvement.
Okay, now, you're well over time. Would you want to spend 1 minute on that last point, which is the question as to whether it goes to Roosevelt or to Wenatchee?
That's not our issue. We take no issue at all on the contract. That's between Seattle Times and Touchstone.
So, whose issue is that one? I thought you were going to talk about
Touchstone.
That. Because is nobody going to talk about that?
Touchstone will come after us, and they have their own.
Oh, there are more people yet. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
I thought we were finished. Okay.
It pleases the court, Jeremy Larson on behalf of Touchstone. This morning I'm going to address two of the principal topics of the multiple appeals before this court that relate to Touchstone. That is the Seattle Times assignments of error on the contract award made by the district court. And secondly, the district court.
Counsel, could you speak up a little? I'm having some difficulty hearing you.
Thank you. I'm going to address two issues. The first is the contract award and the assignments of error made by the Seattle Times on the contract award. The second is the district court's denial of prejudgment interest on that same contract award. My colleague, Mr. Ken Letterman, is going to deal with the issues of Mr. Ritt's status as a prevailing party and the issue.
Could you address that and get it off my mind? It seems to me that Touchstone sued Ritt. Ritt beat him. He was held not to be liable for any money to Touchstone. So under Washington law, he's entitled to attorney's fees against Touchstone. It seems pretty straightforward. I don't quite understand why he's not a prevailing party against Touchstone.
because he also brought claims against Touchstone that he did not prevail on. He and Leathercare sued Touchstone first. Touchstone counterclaimed. Neither party actively pursued claims against each other, which is what the court found, and both sides prevailed against each other in the sense that neither got affirmative relief. Alternatively, you could look at it, both sides failed to prevail because, again, neither side got affirmative relief on the claims of the other. Turning, if I may...
I think you need total relief. I mean, if you sue for $100,000 and you win $50,000, then unless there was an offer of judgment that changes things, you're a prevailing party to the extent of 50.
Well, both sides are equally prevailing parties, Your Honor. Neither side got any affirmative relief against the other. Not limited relief, none. So Rick did not get any.
Have to be a prevailing party, too. If A sues B for $100,000 and the jury says B doesn't owe A a cent, B wins, and B is entitled under Washington law to attorney's fees.
Well, the district court recognized that both Leathercare and Touchstone equally prevailed, both Ritt and Touchstone equally prevailed on their respective claims. That is, neither got affirmative relief against the other. And so both of them were equally prevailing parties. In that instance, the district court just decided to award neither side attorney's fees and didn't declare either one the prevailing party over the other. Now, there were instances that the court addressed less than full recovery on
claims. Just remind me, what were Ritt's claims against Touchstone?
Ritt's claims against Touchstone were for equitable apportionment under MOTCA. And Touchstone's counterclaim back was for the similar equitable apportionment to the extent that Ritt established a basis. Neither side established a basis against the other. Neither side is a prevailing party.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Turning to the main claim and Seattle Times assignments error. Seattle Times makes three assignments error to the district court's findings on the ERIA. The first has to do with truck transport.
We've lost Judge Fletcher.
Okay, I think I'm back in business now. Hello, is anybody on the call?
We're here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, this is Judge Fletcher. I'm now on by telephone because the video connection seems to have failed. But we were talking about attorney's fees. Are we still on attorney's fees?
We didn't do anything once you disappeared, so we're right where we were.
Okay, well let's keep going. And I do not see the time clock, so somebody may want to help me with the time clock because I'm just totally on the phone. I don't have any video at all.
All right, we will.
Okay, so please continue, counsel.
Thank you.
Start the clock.
Thank you, Jeremy Larson again on behalf of Touchstone. I'd now like to turn to the main claim and Seattle Times assignments of error to the district court's award of contract costs under the ERIA. Amounts due and owing to Touchstone for the transportation and disposal of contaminated soil, amounts due and owing from August 30th of 2015. Now, Seattle Times makes three assignments of error with regards to that claim. The first has to do with certain truck transports from Wenatchee. The second has to do with certain sampling that occurred in conjunction with the requirements of the contained out letter required by the Department of Ecology. And the third has to do with that incremental increase in sales tax that Touchstone was required to incur as a result of having to dispose of contaminated soils. Turning to the truck transports to Wenatchee issue, the simple answer to that is Touchstone undertook truck transportation to Wenatchee because it was much cheaper than truck transport down to Roosevelt. Testimony of Shannon Testa at TSR 35 is part of the substantial evidence that the court relied on in making that determination. Nothing in the ERIA gives Seattle Times for them to determine the mode of transportation. Nothing in the ERIA requires only rail transportation. And certainly, Touchstone had the right to transport by truck if need be. It just turns
Counsel?
Out...
Counsel?
Yes.
What's your response to opposing counsel's observation that it still had the authority to determine the location, and that was not adhered to?
Well, counsel is right that Seattle Times have the right to select a designated location, but in so doing, and before the excavation began, it told Touchstone not only that it was selecting Roosevelt, but that Touchstone had the availability to, or B, via another feasible option that was less expensive than option A, Roosevelt. So in this letter,
in the contract.
Point to the language.
So this is in TSER 766. It's a letter from.
Is that Martin. Part of the contract?
It's not part of the contract itself. It's part of the designation that Seattle Times made to Touchstone with regard to where the facility was. So in the contract, Seattle Times didn't designate the facility. After the contract was signed and before excavation began, Seattle Times designated a facility, but said in that very designation at TSER 766, or a less expensive viable option. And that's exactly what Touchstone did. And Washington law recognizes this, even if it wasn't in the contract, under the Scott Paper decision that says where a method of performance is not available, an alternative method of performance that does not prejudice the other party is acceptable. And indeed here, not only was it not prejudicial to Seattle Times, it actually saved them incremental costs that would otherwise been more because of the truck costs to Roosevelt versus Wenatchee. So there was substantial evidence that supports the district court's determination that this properly fell within incremental costs. Turning to the issue of sampling, there was certain sampling that had to be done in conjunction with the proper disposal of the contaminated soils. This was required by the Washington Department of Ecology's contained in agreement. Required, among other things, this is at TSER 768L, that record keeping be kept of the precise amounts of contaminated soil that were shipped so that it could be logged and trucked in accordance with ecology's determinations. So in order to properly dispose of contaminated soils, this record keeping had to happen. And the district court found this record keeping was part of the necessary costs of properly transporting and disposing contaminated soils. Again, substantial evidence supports the district court's finding in that regard. Finally, with regard to sales tax, Touchstone only asked for, and the district court only awarded, that incremental increase on sales tax over the cost of the entire project that was attributable to the necessary transportation of contaminated soils and disposal of those contaminated soils. Again, substantial evidence supports the district court's finding that this was part of the necessary costs.
Counsel, when you refer to SER 766, which appeal record is that in?
So that's in the main appeal, Your Honor. Oh, I beg your pardon. That's in the
give
prejudgment.
Give me the number, the case appeal case number.
That would be... It is case 18-35773, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
I might have misspoke. That might be the prejudgment appeal. My apologies. But turning to the issue of prejudgment interest, on that same contract award, the district court made an error of Washington law when it decided, as a matter of law, that Touchstone was not entitled to prejudgment interest on its contract. Now, the way the court added up the contract claim and awarded it to Touchstone was to take the very same invoices that Touchstone submitted to the Seattle Times, determine whether there was evidentiary support for them and whether they fell within the definition of incremental cost based on its fact-finding endeavor, and then when it was done, add up those costs and determine what the cost recovery was for Touchstone, the quintessential case of a liquidated cost recovery in Washington. District court erred as a matter of law in finding these unliquidated under Washington law, and therefore the court properly reviews that decision de novo for this court's decision in Polar Products and Santa Barbara. Also, the Washington decision of McConnell makes it clear that where a court decides as a matter of law claims are unliquidated, that's reviewed de novo. Now, here the court made two fundamental errors of Washington law. The first was the court simply misapplied the car wash versus Compenos case. That was a case that did not involve a contract for cost recovery. That was a case that had no cost recovery contract to look at, no way to add up the costs. Instead, the court was left to do a Matka analysis, which is, of course, unliquidated, and determine the parties' respective liabilities on that basis. Here, there was a contract. Indeed, the only claim Touchstone brought against the Seattle Times was on a contract for cost recovery. Compenos simply does not apply to the facts of this case. The court compounded its error when it decided as a matter of law the case was too complex for the claim to be liquidated. There is no Washington authority to support this, and indeed, the Washington Supreme Court rejected that argument in the Weyerhaeuser case, where it said the complexity of a case doesn't render a claim unliquidated, and indeed, even the presence of some unliquidated claims doesn't render liquidated claims unliquidated. So you can have a claim in multiple parts, some of which is liquidated, which you're entitled to under Washington substantive law to prejudgment interest on, and other claims that are not. In this case, we only had one claim, one liquidated claim for contract recovery. So we would ask that this court reverse the trial court and direct entry of judgment on the prejudgment interest. It was due and owing the last invoice, August 30th, 2015, for the time of judgment, September 30th, 2018, in the amount of $1,046,472. I had a little feedback. Did the court hear my last point?
I have a question about the your citation to SCR 766. Is that the letter dated July
29, 2014?
Yeah.
Yes, it starts 765, and it's
correct.
Signed.
Mm-hmm. Point me to the language that you are referencing that gives Touchstone the ability to go to a different site.
So in paragraph 2, counsel says, it designates Republic Services disposed of at the Roosevelt Regional Subtitle D landfill. Now, it also purports to cite by rail, but of course, Seattle Times doesn't have that right under the RIA. And then it says, or B, via another feasible option that is less expensive than option A, the Roosevelt Regional Subtitle D landfill, which is exactly what Touchstone did when it sent the contaminated waste to Wenatchee when rail cars were not available to go to Roosevelt. Thank you, Your Honor. If there's no further questions, I'll turn the matter over to Mr. Leatherman at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. May it please the court, my name is Ken Leatherman, co-counsel for Touchstone in this matter. I was planning to address the issue of prevailing party status between Stephen Ritt individually and Touchstone. However, Mr. Larson very effectively answered those questions when posed by Judge Kleinfeld. At this time, if there are no further questions, I will address only the last argument on Touchstone's list, which is the issue of attorney's fees. Seattle Times has appealed the award of attorney's fees against Seattle Times under the contract. There was no appeal by Leathercare of the attorney's fees awarded to Touchstone under Matka. There are two primary flaws in Seattle Times' position in this matter. First, Seattle Times argues that this is a Matka-driven case, but it is not. The driver of Touchstone's claims against Seattle Times was the contract. And in the final ruling and findings of fact and conclusions of law from the court clearly acknowledged that there were two separate claims, there were two separate judgments, there were two separate prevailing party determinations in Touchstone's favor, and two separate fee awards. And the one given to Touchstone from Seattle Times was solely under the contract. The second flaw in Seattle Times' arguments is that they set forth a burdensome and overly rigid process that is not required or mandated under Washington law. Touchstone followed the Lodestar process and provided ample documentation and information about its rates, about the work that was done, and made its best reasonable effort to segregate those fees wherever possible. The court followed by making very detailed findings as to which attorney's fees were recoverable and which were not. The court made several hundred thousand dollars of reductions, which we have not appealed, as those reductions were within the court's wide discretion. And the court very clearly documented with regard to the separate prevailing party determinations versus MACA and under the contract. The court's analysis and decisions with regard to the attorney's fee award are entirely within the district court's wide discretion, and Seattle Times has presented nothing in its briefing that merits a remand to the district court. As such, we ask that the court uphold the court's finding as to attorney's fees. At this time, Your Honor, we have nothing further unless there are further questions.
Not for me.
Then we appreciate the court's time. Thank you again.
Are you there, Judge Fletcher? I think we lost Judge Fletcher again. Sam?
Yes, Judge, I'll try giving him a call.
All right.
Can you see me now?
Yes, you're back.
You can hear me. Okay, because I've been and hearing you for a while. Okay.
Last thing that you heard, Judge Fletcher? You heard all of the last argument?
I heard all of the last argument. I heard some of it by telephone, and then I heard it more when I got back on screen. So I'm back in business, at least for the time being.
Okay.
So, Mrs. Sullivan, you've got rebuttal. Let's put 3 minutes on the clock and see what happens.
Thank you so much. We try to make 4 points on rebuttal. First, on harmless error. This is very important. They essentially, Leather Care argues, no harm, no foul. You know, we know what the district court would do. No, we don't. We would be speculating how the district court would have resolved the 113F counterclaim on which Leather Care bore the burden. And we know that because the only times the district court used the word burden in its opinion was putting the burden on Seattle Times or on Touchstone.
What do we make of the argument, though, that in allocating under Washington law, the district judge did the same burden as he should have done, in your view, with respect to CERCLA, and under that burden of proof with respect to Washington law, he made the findings that he would have made under CERCLA. How do you respond to that argument?
Yes, how I respond to that? Again, he put the burden on the Seattle Times. And so we don't know how it would come out on, we certainly don't know how it would come out on the CERCLA claim, but not even on the MACA claim. If the burden under the law was on Leather Care, the court should have proceeded in an orderly fashion. First, ruling on the CERCLA, the 107A claim, then 113F, then on the state law claim. So we just would be speculating, especially on this orphan share issue. It's very clear that the court was putting the burden on the Seattle Times to determine that there was an orphan share, that Troy's successors had no assets, et cetera. And the Fourth Circuit has made clear, Minyard Enterprises, if the burden of proof is improperly allocated, you send it back for the district court to determine in the first instance and not for the Court of Appeals to guess. Second point on operator liability, what Leather Care, and RIT are defining as facility is just entirely at odds with the text of CERCLA, which defines facility broadly, and their own stipulation, LeatherCare stipulated there was a release from a facility to say so only the facility was somehow the sewers and the dump truck is not consistent with their own stipulation or with CERCLA itself or with the State Ecology Agreed Order, which considered the entire property to be a facility. And if you have any questions about if you can escape liability, if you dump PCE down someone else's drain, I urge the court to look at a district court case we cited, Lincoln Properties, from Judge Levy in the Eastern District of California. Third, on Touchstone, to try to go back to these contract issues, Touchstone has been very clear. The only reason they wanted to go to a different location was to avoid construction delays, and that is carved out of the definition of incremental costs. And Judge Zille recognized that in not giving them a premium for Saturday delivery. And essentially what Touchstone is asking here is a premium for delivering to their location of choice.
Counsel, what's your response to opposing counsel's reliance on the letter designating the facility as giving the option to take a less expensive route?
A couple responses there. First, of course, it's parole evidence, and the district court said he didn't consider any extrinsic evidence. He was relying on the contract itself. So that argument is inconsistent with the district court's own reasoning. And secondly, it goes back to the discussion I had with Judge Fletcher earlier about which was actually cheaper. Their assertion is that it was cheaper to go to Wenatchee, but that's not what the invoices to Seattle Times demonstrates. If there are no further questions from the panel, we'd ask that you reverse and remand with instructions to the district court to correct its errors.
Okay, thank you. Thank all sides for their arguments. And let me make sure I get the name of the case correctly. Seattle Times versus LeatherCare et al. Now submitted for decision. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.